All right, please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Tonight, our 40-minute guest speaker is Jonathan from Trabuco Canyon.
Good evening, my name is Jonathan Mitchell and I'm an alcoholic. Can everyone hear me in the back?
A little louder.
How about now? Move this up a little bit. And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Kathleen, so much for inviting me. This is a real honor and a privilege. I was given the gift of sobriety May 2nd, 2002. And I have a couple of home groups and a couple of sponsors. I want to say happy birthday to Tom and the other birthday woman. One of my sponsors has 48 years, you know, and he reminds me regularly that speaking from the podium, especially as the main speaker, is the lowest form of service you can do in alcoholics. He's not very impressed with me either. So. But it's interesting, about a month ago, I was out driving around, and I love big speaker meetings like this. I love sitting down, getting that cup of coffee in my hand, kicking back, and listening to stories. Monday and Tuesday night, the speaker meetings I go to are very big, you know, maybe from 200 to 400 people on any given night. They're very large, 200 to 300 people probably. And about a month ago, it was a Friday, it was during the day, and I decided I was going to pull into a noon meeting. I pull in this noon meeting, I looked it up in the directory, and I get there, and it's one of those meetings where I show up a couple of minutes late, and there's only two people in the meeting, you know. And I thought, oh, man, come on, you know. Because then I couldn't leave, you know, I thought I felt bad, you know. And so there's these two, like, you know, older ladies, and We sit down and have a meeting, and then another person comes, and it was one of those meetings where I'd forgotten how cool it is to have an intimate meeting like that, you know. I go to these big speaker meetings sometimes, and I get caught up in working the room and being friendly and loving and polite and trying to welcome all these newcomers. But what happened during that meeting is there was only a few of us, like I said, and all the egos got dropped, you know. There was no grandstanding, and everyone got, like, real honest. And it was like one of the best meetings I've ever, like, you know, I've ever been to. It was really nice. And afterward, this 80-year-old woman came up to me and she said, "Jonathan, you know," she goes, "when I talk to you, it makes me wish I was younger." And I said, "Well, why is that?" And she said, "Well," she said, "when I meet young people like you, it just makes me want to hang out in Alcoholics Anonymous forever." And I thought, wow, you know, just what a great compliment. Just, geez. So I drive away from that meeting, and I'm just like floating, right? I'm just in a great spot. And I decide I'm going to reward myself. I'm going to have a nice lunch. I go into a California Pizza Kitchen. I pull in, and I order my food, and I'm just in that real grateful, centered spot. You know, that real just grateful, centered spiritual spot. And I'm like almost on the verge of tears. My food comes, and I'm going to say a quick prayer, you know, right before I eat my food, and all of a sudden, this guy comes running up to me in the middle of the restaurant, just screaming my name. And he's like, "Jonathan, Jonathan, don't you remember me?" And I look up at him, and I have no clue who he is. He says, "Don't you remember me? 3 years ago, you 12-stepped me, and now I'm the manager of this restaurant." I was like, "Oh my God!" You know? And I just start bawling right there in the middle of the restaurant, guys. I mean, I just lose it. I'm crying, he's crying, and he's like the manager, you know. And it was one of those things, you know, AA, it's just full circle, man. Just full circle, you know. We give it, we get it, we give it, we give it, you know, get it back. It all comes back around full circle. It's just a beautiful program. You know, if you're new in here tonight, I want to welcome you. And if you're in a treatment center, I especially want to welcome you. Bill Wilson, our founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, he also was professionally treated for alcoholism. So I want to say I welcome you and we're glad you're here. You know, I also got introduced to AA in a druggy buggy, you know. It's a big green van, shipped us to meetings. I didn't stay sober, however. But I want to tell you a little bit about my drinking, but before I get into my drink, I'll tell you a little bit about my childhood. I remember it was when I was 4 years old, I ran away from daycare. And they put me in time out, and I just knew that wasn't going to work. They found me a couple hours later. I just wanted to go swimming. You know, I grew up in South Texas. It was hot summer day. I just wanted to go swimming. So they found me. And see, that's it. Defiance has always been my outstanding characteristic. You tell me to go left, I'll go right. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. That's the attitude I've always had. I remember, this was long before I took a drink. Long before I took a drink of alcohol. I remember I was like 9 years old, fifth grade. Everyone used to wear those big puffy starter jackets, right? And those big nylon jackets. And I remember, you know, we'd go through the lunch line, and for an extra quarter, you could get a chocolate milk. Well, that price was too high for me. I would just steal the chocolate milks, and then we would go run around the corner, and we would have chocolate milk drinking contests, right? Because intuitively, at that young age, I knew if one chocolate milk was good, five chocolate milks were better. Yeah. It's true. And that's like the obsession, right? Or the physical allergy, right? I ingest one thing, and I'll steal your property to ingest as many more as quickly as I possibly can. No matter what it is, give me more. And that's how my drinking was. You know, it was a perfect, you know, I guess perfect prequel to my drinking, I guess you could say. I don't know. But, you know, growing up in high school, I was like a star golfer. I was on the golf team. You know, I hit a hole-in-one one time in regulation golf. It was a big deal. I got my name in the paper. And, you know, I could break 80 in high school. That was kind of a big deal in Texas at that time. You know, Tiger Woods was getting popular, and we were all playing golf. And my freshman year, I think I was like number two on the golf team. You know, there was five slots. I was number two on the varsity golf team. And I just, that was like my love, my passion. You know, as I was out there playing golf, I just loved it, you know. And what happened was I got a job as a cart boy at a golf course. And about 6 months into that job, I decided, it was a Friday night, and there was a party. We had heard there was a party, and I decided, oh, we're going to go to this party. And my family, they had some Boone Strawberry Hill wine, right? And it's the wine that's never touched a grape, right? So we get to drinking this wine, you know, and it's just, I just thought, oh my God, I have arrived. You know, this is my first drink of alcohol. I just loved it. You know, I love the effect produced by drinking. You know, I felt comfortable. I felt popular. Just like what it says, you know, a lot of people, you guys have heard this. I just felt that ease and comfort that came once from that first drink. And you know, we went to a party later on that night after we got off the golf course. I started drinking at the job. We get to the party, people are passing around the square golden bottle, and you know, it comes around to me, I drink it, I can't get it down, it keeps coming back up. Finally, the third time I drink it, it goes down, and man, I just felt that warm sensation in my stomach, you know. And that's what alcohol does for me, man. I just love the effect of feeling different than anxious. And you know, that night I ended up doing all the alcoholic things we do. You know, blacked out, passed out, you know, wet the bed, yada, 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 the list goes on. And I got in some big trouble that night. And that was the beginning of my drinking. And then it progressed through high school. What happened is we lived in Texas, we lived about an hour and 10 minutes away from a border town. And there was a bar, my favorite bar in Mexico. It's called Up and Downs. It was four stories. They had a fireman's pole running all the way through the middle. And there was mirrors, and they played three songs on repeat. And for $10, you could drink all night long. And that's kind of how it was in Mexico. And we would go across the border. If you guys have ever seen the movie No Country for Old Men, that was where we would cross, that exact spot where they filmed that movie. And so we would go across that border there, and for $10, we could drink all the Corona and tequila you would ever imagine. And that was it. That was it. I had arrived. And, you know, I saw things over there no 15, 16-year-old should ever see. True. But, you know, what ended up happening is I ended up getting out of high school. I got an apartment, and it went downhill. You know, I'm the kind of alcoholic, I end up isolating, right? I end up isolating, and I end up paranoid, right? Because I like to do other things that enhance my drinking, right? And so they ended up doing an intervention on me. I got sent to treatment. I went to treatment, got introduced to AA, couldn't stay sober, kept drinking. Then for 1 year, I went in and out of that door in AA. And I got into that spot where I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get sober. Couldn't get drunk, couldn't get sober. I couldn't get loaded, and I couldn't get sober. Booze wasn't working. Drugs weren't working. Nothing was working, and sobriety wasn't working. Just a horrible, horrible place. It was basic. I felt like I was in hell on earth. I just felt miserable. And during that year of going in and out, I burned every bridge in my life. Finally, at the end of it, my family, they started going to Al-Anon. I showed up to my parents' house one day. I was on like a three-day binge. No one had seen me in 3 days. I was in a hotel room. I had pulled the smoke detectors off the wall. I thought there was for sure police surveillance cameras there. And I go to my parents' house, and they had started going to Al-Anon, and they started watching these Tough Love tapes. You guys remember those Tough Love? And they had everything I owned in these Rubbermaid containers. They were sitting out front, and the doors were locked. They had changed the locks on the doors, and I started opening up these containers. And sure enough, what happened is I saw a photo album, and it had all my baby pictures in there. And I thought, I'm in deep shit now, you know. I just thought, geez, you know. And that's what they told me. They said, you know, we never want to see you again. We don't even want to have any memories of you. Just get out. So I went down to the local bookstore, and I bought an atlas. And I decided, well, I got to get out of town. So I decided I was going to come back to Southern California because I'd gotten introduced to a halfway house out here. So I got in my car, I got my Rubbermaid containers, and I drove from San Antonio all the way to Newport Beach. And I arrived on a Sunday night. It was a speaker meeting in Newport, the Newport Club. Sunday night speaker there. And a gentleman walked up to me, and he pointed his finger at my chest. And he said, "Have you admitted to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic?" And I said, "Yes. I just drove all the way here, you know." And see, that's the kind of arrogance I have, you see. It's so interesting. The other day, there was a guy. You know, he was hanging out, and he was dirty. He had been sleeping outside. And I went over to him, and he was digging some stuff out of the dumpster. And I gave him, I folded up some money. I gave it to him. And I said, "Here you go, man." He said, "I don't need your help." And see, and that's me too, man. I don't need your help. Don't you know who I am? And see, I totally related with that guy. Needless to say, I convinced him to take the money. You know, I said, "Dude, just take the money. Dude, here's a couple bucks." And, but that's it. That's the kind of defiance and arrogance that I have, my disease has. You know, "Don't you help me? Don't you know who I am?" That some people call it the unripe ego. But, you know, so I ended up getting sober in Long Beach, and that was my sobriety date's May 2nd, 2002, like I said. And for me, growing up in Texas, I grew up around a lot of racism and prejudice, just a lot of fear-based people in my life. And when I got to California, I intuitively knew that that wasn't going to work anymore. So I got put into sober living, and I made friends with all kinds of people, you know, different people from, you know, different backgrounds, different countries, different genders, different, you know, sexual orientation, whatever. I just made friends with everybody, and I learned quickly that if I could accept you, I had a chance at accepting myself, you know. And this program, it taught me a lot of wonderful things. Mainly, the best thing it probably taught me is how to get along with people. And I fall short on it all the time. But this program, I swear, through the 11th step mainly, through that prayer and meditation, what happens is I become more equal to all of you. And people ask me all the time. Some people know, there's people in here, they know the lifestyle I live. They say, "Jonathan, you meditate 2 or 3 hours a day. Does that make you more spiritual?" I say, "Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It just makes me more equal. It just makes me fit in a little better. It just makes me closer and equal to all of you. That's all it does. So I got sober. I was working two jobs. And I was working at Sears and Blockbuster Video. 7-8 months sober, my brother called. He said, "Jonathan, they want you to come home." I was like, "Oh my God!" They hadn't talked to me. It was Christmas, and I had saved some money working those two jobs. I got some gifts, and I got to go back home to my family on Christmas Day, and I got to give them all Christmas presents. And see, that might not mean much to some of you, but see, for the longest time, alcoholism, my disease, it made me a taker. And in the 7-8 months sober or whatever it was I had turned into a giver. You know, I got to make some of those amends and I got my family back. I didn't even know I wanted my family back, but I got them back anyway. It was great. And I remember, like, my family was so happy that I got them Christmas gifts. They just couldn't believe it. You know, to see me in the state I was, to see me where I am now, or where I was at that point. But, you know, so 1 year sober, 2 years sober, right? You guys know the drill. In AA, you get sober and you get active, right? I started my first year sober. I say this, and I say this because my first year sober, guys, I went to probably 500 to 600 meetings my first year. I went to meetings every chance I got. I got involved with H&I, like the gentleman was talking about tonight. I was doing a panel a week. I was just on fire. I had commitments at all my meetings. I had a sponsor, I was accountable, I was getting honest, and I was just enthusiastic about AA. Here's why. I found a sense of ease and comfort from doing service work in Alcoholics Anonymous that was better than what alcohol and drugs were doing for me. I got a glimpse of that. And that sustained me. That sustained me through the tough times. You know, what ended up happening is I ended up getting some better jobs and getting into school, and I got some money to go to school, and I ended up getting a girlfriend, and she was very attractive. We ended up moving in together, and I drifted slowly and slowly away out of the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, slowly I kind of traded it in. I traded in the things I was doing, you know, for material things, for this, for that. Basically, it became second on my priority list, and that's the worst lie I tell myself. And I see it again and again, right? You hear people, they take chips, girl gets up. I see it all the time. It just makes me so sad. She's got 1 year sober. She's like, "I've been hitting my knees. I've been calling my sponsor. I've been going to meetings. And I enrolled in school." And then people clap for the part that, you know, she was going to school. It's like, dude, come on. She's going, she's praying. She's going to meetings. To me, that's more clap worthy than going to school. And I just say that because, see, I don't want to ever lose focus again. So I remind myself this. What is my primary purpose? It says on page 77 that our primary purpose is to fit ourselves with maximum service to God and our fellows. That is my truth. That is what has worked for me. You know, and so I got sober and I'm staying sober. I'm getting years and I'm going and I'm accumulating all kinds of wonderful things. Wonderful people, girlfriend, job, apartments, things I love, things I like, beautiful friends. I got a fellowship built around me. And then about 5 years sober, I got a secretary commitment. I got another secretary commitment. And I started getting a little more plugged back in, but I didn't really get all the way plugged back in. And then at 6 years sober, my first grand sponsor, he had 34 years sober. He got drunk and he died. And I thought, oh my God. You see, that's the disease of alcoholism. And so he died on a Sunday. We went to a service. On a Wednesday night, his best friend, Johnny H. from Bellflower, was speaking at the Wednesday night meeting in Laguna. And I walked through that thank you speaker line, and Johnny recognized me at the service, and he grabbed me by the arm and he said, "Jonathan, don't let who you are in AA take you out the door of AA." He said, "It happened to Bob and it can happen to me and it's going to happen to you." And I thought, wow, you know. And so what happened is I kind of got back down into a rut in the program. I kind of got into a depression. What I was doing was I was basically living a life of the extreme most amount of just vanity and materialism. You know, what happened is I ended up staying, I would spend some of my summers in Las Vegas, and then the last summer I spent in Las Vegas, I spent 2 months there, and it was basically just like the worst possible thing anyone could do for spiritual growth. This was the opposite. Oh, Lord. And, you know, this is how it was. You know, I played in these poker tournaments. I played in the, you know, the biggest poker tournament in the world. And, you know, I met some celebrities and I made friends with some people that I used to see on TV, and I just thought it was like, wow, what a blessing, you know. And I had the car I'd always wanted at one point. You know, I remember when I was new, I wanted a BMW M3, and at 5 years sober, I got that, and then I got caught driving at 154 miles an hour. And I caught a felony reckless driving. And I don't share that to sound like a big shot, I swear. I share that because, guys, if I'm not working a program, my thinking and my behavior is worse than my drinking. It's worse because there's no anesthetic for the pain. You see, and what was needed was, is I needed to recommit myself back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And what was required is me getting sober again, getting emotional sobriety, recommitting myself to a new sponsor, going back through the steps again and getting honest about the things and the misbehaviors I was doing well into sobriety. And so I guess I share that with you, newcomer, because, you know, you can save yourself a lot of pain. You know, you can save yourself a lot of pain if you just try to keep AA the number one priority. That's what they say. If you put AA first, you will have a first-class life. I'm telling you that that wasn't always the case for me. There was times where I misplaced my loyalty to Alcoholics Anonymous. I misplaced my loyalty to spiritual principles. And I kind of turned my back on the higher power at one point. And I just thought, you know what? I'm just kind of done with all of that. I just don't, I've outgrown it or something. I don't know what I was thinking, but what ended up happening is one night I got down on my knees. I was in so much pain, guys. I just was so miserable, and I was miserable long into sobriety, and I got down on my knees and I realized that I didn't have to get drunk to start over, right? And so if you're in here tonight, no matter how much time you have, that's my experience. You don't have to get drunk to start over. You know, and I got down on my knees one night and I said, God, if you get me out of this sadness, if you get me out of this misery, if you get me out of this pain I'm experiencing, I swear I'll dedicate the rest of my life to the service of you and my fellow men. And you guys know what I do for a living. Some of you know, I mean, I'm still paying that debt back still to this day. And but that's it. The people that know me, they know that I walk the walk. It's true. I do H&I. I go to a ton of meetings. I got commitments at all my meetings. I sponsor some guys. I do stuff like this. You know, I do anything I can for Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I'm that unselfish, really. You know, I heard my sponsor, I talked to my sponsor today, and he said, Jonathan, he said, before we get sober and long into our sobriety, it's me, 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 me. He said, the thing with you in the last 2 years, what I've noticed is now it's still me, 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 me. But now there's a you in there. And you see, and that you makes all the difference. And that's kind of it. I've become a little more unselfish, right? A little more unselfish. And I just try to, you know, work that into my life on a daily basis. And guys, if you're in here tonight and you're thinking about joining AA and you're thinking about, you know, giving this program a shot, it's not about looking perfect or sounding perfect or having all the things outside perfect. But I promise you this, my friends, if you can muster up just a little bit of unselfishness, I swear it'll go a long way. That is what is needed. If you can get a little bit of that unselfishness, you can get a taste of what it feels like to have the inner life, the inner joy, the inner bliss awaken, and then you'll catch fire for Alcoholics Anonymous because you'll realize that there's something to be had through working spiritual principles that is far better than drugs and alcohol. You see, and that's what I found. You see, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you'll revert back to where you were. If you don't find something better than drinking. You know, there's a great teacher that said, it's a peace that passeth all understanding. There's old timers in these rooms. They call it a priceless gift of serenity. A priceless gift of serenity. That's what I found. Now, I'll share with you another story. So I recommit myself to AA. How much time do I have? 14 minutes, right? Is that right?
9:25.
Okay, great. So I recommit myself to AA, right? I'm on the East Coast. I'm visiting some friends. And my grandmother, right? My grandmother was my favorite person in my family. She was my closest family member. I don't know if you guys love grandmas. For me, I always loved my grandma. She was like my number one person. So she called everyone in the family, right? And she said, I want everyone to come home. So what we did was we all got together in Dallas. She was living in Dallas at the time. And all of my aunts and uncles, we all got together and we all got to spend 2 days with Grandma. Grandma was sick. She was in hospice. And she said a lot of really important things to me. The one thing she said to me, she said, "Jonathan, if you really want happiness, you'll forgive your mom." And she knew that I was still holding on to some resentment there. And so after the end of the second day, she called everyone in the room. And she said, "Guys, come in. So she goes, "You know, it's going to be real strange not waking up tomorrow." And her breathing started to get slow and her eyes started to get heavy. And she said, "But I want to let all of you know that no matter what you've done, no matter what you've gone through, no matter what mistakes you think you have made, I want to let you know something. God and I love you no matter what." And so her breathing started to get heavy, and we're like all on the edge of tears. And she looks up at the light in the room and she says, "My God, it's so beautiful." And she goes, right there. And it was like the pinnacle of my life, guys. It was the pinnacle of my life. I was the kind of alcoholic, I couldn't show up for anything. I was the kind of person, I would tell you I'd be there, and I just wouldn't show up. And I got to show up in that moment. I got to be there with that person. I got to be there with my family. It was just one of the most amazing experiences. So later on that week, I went and visited my cousin. I had a cousin in prison. He had stolen some things from Home Depot, and he copped a case, and I went to go visit him. And I filled out the forms, and I go into the visiting place, and they have all the phones are behind the big glass, right? We all know what this looks like. And so I walk over to him, and he's sitting there with the phone in his hand. And I go up, and I look up, and I look through the glass at him, and he's like crying, just bawling. And I pick up the phone, and he says, "Jonathan," he says, "I've been waiting for 2 years for you to come visit me." He said, "I got a sponsor and a big book, and I go to 2 meetings a week inside here, and I can't wait to go to a meeting with you when I get out." And I thought, wow. He said, "I saw how Alcoholics Anonymous has worked in your life, and I'm willing to go to any length to put these principles in my life." He says, "You've completely turned your life around." And so that's what I want to share with you. If you're in here and you have some time, don't be hard on yourself for anything you think you might have done, any kind of mistakes you've done in sobriety. Because see, I used to think, well, I was kind of goofed off in sobriety. I kind of could have maybe put more effort into it. But see, even when I was goofing off, there was no mistake there, you see. And that's what happens, guys. Every experience that we have becomes a tool in the tool belt. It all becomes arrows in the quiver. There are no mistakes at the end. Yes, our behavior does get us into some pain. And yes, we will misbehave and we will get into some pain. That's human nature. But what happens is like it says in the book, we learn not to regret anything, right? It says we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. So, so that kind of gave me a boost, right? And I'm back in AA, I'm doing my thing, and I end up a little while later, I get a call from my aunt, right? And I hadn't spoken to my mom in 10 years. I was super resentful at my mom. She stole my identity. She just kind of ran amok. She has alcoholism. She was sober at one point. She stole many things from our family, just completely ruined our family. I thought so. And what happened is my aunt called me and said, "You know, you might want to come visit your mom. She's in the hospital." And my mom had hepatitis C. She had jaundice, and she had been sleeping outdoors. And I thought, I don't know. You know, I called my sponsor, and he said, "Jonathan, why don't you go visit your mom, not to see your mom. Forget your feelings about your mom." He said, "Why don't you go down there and see if you can be of service to the rest of your family in some way?" And I thought, oh, that sounds pretty good, you know. So I drove to this hospital. I get down there. Guys, I walk in this room, and I swear to God, it was like being rocketed directly into the fourth dimension. All of a sudden, I could see that God had been behind all of this. I looked in this woman's face, just a train wreck. I looked at this woman's face, and all of a sudden I had this moment of unconditional love that I am incapable of having. It was like for 10 seconds, my eyes became the eyes of God. And I looked at this woman just as like God would see her, perfect as ever. I just didn't see anything wrong with her. And I had this outflowing of love. I just couldn't believe it. And once this happened, she looked at me and she recognized who I was, and she says, you know, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I just came to see if I could help. Is there anything I can do? And they were trying to decide what to do with her, to put her in a treatment center, to put her in a psychiatric ward, a detox, they didn't know. And I looked at her, and see, I didn't even call her mom. I just said, Margot, you and I both know, you just need to go back to AA. And she said, he's right. And so they ended up getting her into like a treatment center, and she's now sober 18 months, right? It's beautiful. Right? She got a lot of wreckage, you know, and she went to prison once. She's like a convicted felon, and she got another case. You know, she does these white collar crimes, and recently, before the last couple of months, I was sending her Walmart gift cards, right? Because she was in a sober living house, and she was like the most popular girl in her sober living. She was getting her friends all the sodas. She was like the soda girl in her sober living. But recently, like two, three weeks ago, my aunt called me and said, you know, I want to bail your mom out. I want to get her a lawyer and take care of all of her legal fees and pay back all of her restitution. And she said, are you willing to help? And I said, yes. And what I ended up doing is I ended up signing over half of this apartment building that I inherited from her mom and said, you know what, just use all that money, just pay it all back. There you go. And see, that's it. I go to Al-Anon too, right? And I can participate in a loving and detached way. You see what I'm saying? Because for the longest time, I was the kind of guy, I was a cut-and-run kind of guy. I just Windex people out of my life. Not done with you. Every person in my life, even people in my sobriety life, friends of mine in sobriety, I had like throwaway friendships. You know, just whatever, you annoyed me this one time, and I'm going to judge your whole life based on this one moment. Get out. You guys relate with that. Isn't that funny? So that's it, right? Her mom, my grandmother on my mom's side, gave me that apartment building because my mom was in prison at that time. She got out. Now she's sober. I just gave it back to her. I really don't think it ever belonged to me anyway. So she's doing great. You know, she's super happy. That's a huge weight off of her shoulders. You know, she was looking at going back to prison for 5 to 20 years. You know. And all I had to do was sign this one notary paper saying, hey, use this money for that. You know, I have so many wonderful stories. Those are some of them. You know, I'll talk to you a little bit about the steps, I guess. You know, I've had to work the steps many, many times. Many, many times. And, you know, after forgiving my mom, I went to my sponsor. I had two sponsors at the time. Like I said, one had 46 years at the time, and the other one had like, 28. And they both looked at me and they said, Jonathan, you have had a genuine spiritual awakening. You have been transformed. And that's exactly how I felt. All of a sudden, guys, it was like I literally lost interest in selfish things and gained interest in my fellows. I mean, it was a transformative experience. I woke up one morning and I thought, every decision in my entire life has been based on fear. I was living in a really nice place. It was in Orange Park Acres. It was a nice home I was renting from a friend. And I had a nice car and I walked outside, guys, and I wanted to vomit. I mean, basically, I had really lost the desire to have anything for myself. I realized that how could I ever even enjoy any of the gifts I had knowing that there was other people in my family suffering, and I wasn't doing nothing for them. So I sold my car, I moved out, and I basically, guys, I stripped my life completely down. And if you stay in here a while, you'll hear other old-timers say this. They'll say, my first couple of years sober was my best time. And so that's exactly what I tried to do. That's exactly what I've been trying to do recently. I've stripped my life all the way completely down. I have a car. It's worth $1,500. So that's how much I paid for it. I have a little room, right? And I just have completely simplified my life. I boiled it all the way back down because I don't want to forget why I'm here. I don't want to forget my primary purpose. My primary purpose is you. My primary purpose is this. My primary purpose is Alcoholics Anonymous.
I got nothing left. This is it. This is why I believe I was put on the planet. To be a good member of AA. To be a basic, sober human being. That's all I want to be. Just a normal, basic, good member of my home group. If I die and that's on my headstone, I'll be completely happy with that. Everything else is just a bonus gift. And some of you might think, well, I want a Ferrari or something. Or a PhD or something like that. And that's good too. Go do those things. Do everything you want in sobriety. For me, though, I found literally, guys, through being of service in AA, like I said before, I've found something far greater than all of that in the 11th step. And if you're in here tonight and you have some time and you're claiming to have worked all 12 steps, I just want to remind you that the prayer and meditation part of the 11th step, it's not extra credit. It's not. Because a lot of times, people come up to me and they say, Jonathan, you've only been sober 10 years. How did you get such peace of mind? You're so happy. You're glowing. How do you do it? And I say, guys, it's all about that 11th step, you see. For me, it's all about that 11th step. Because if I can get centered and get accountable and honest in that 10th step, what will happen for me is that 11th step, it basically just takes care of my whole life. If I'm centered in prayer and meditation, if my life is centered in that 11th step, nothing external can bother me. Nothing. I can just accept it as it is. I've gotten in these spaces, these spiritual moments, weeks, months, days, where I have that unbroken compassion for people. And that is a beautiful place to be. I wish that for all of you. If you can catch a glimpse of that, I swear, guys, it is worth it. This program is worth it. It's worth the ride. It's worth the pain. It's worth the ups and downs. That 12th step, right? It says it clearly. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, continue to carry the message. Continue to carry the message. Because for me, I don't ever want to rest on what I think I've earned in AA. You know, and I'm constantly, you know, being active, and I'm constantly trying to do more and more for this place as maximum as I can. You know, I'm always trying to go maximum. I'm an all or nothing kind of guy. And I feel as though I've just gone all in with this program. I've just gone all in. I got nothing left. This is it. And I hate to sound fanatical. I don't know. Basically, I can't believe that I've been able to find satisfaction. My first year, 8 years sober, guys, I was so irritable, restless, and discontent. I mean, I would just gamble and just do anything I could to feel separate from myself. You know, at 5 years, at 8 years, 7 years sober, I had a girlfriend, or I was dating this girl, she had 5 years sober, and I was gambling a lot. And I was the kind of guy, I would gamble, I would go play some poker, and this is kind of an outside issue, but I just share this because what I was searching for in gambling was the ability to concentrate. You see, I'd lost that ability. I would be so resentful at my mom, I would try to go to school, I dropped in and out of school 4 times. I would be so resentful at my mom, guys. I would read a book like this, and I would open it up, right? And I would read a page, and I would close it. And 10 seconds later, I would forget what I've read, you see? And that was how angry I was. And I was just clutching on to that resentment. So I forgave my mom, started meditating, and I realized that what I was searching for in, like, gambling or shopping or any of these other things was just that ability to stay present in the moment. So, I got some time sober. I'm hanging out with this girl. She has 5 years sober, and I'm playing cards one night. And she shows up where I'm playing cards, and she's like, she started drinking, and I was like blown away. And she knew that I had played. She knew where I was at, and she was 5 years sober, and she was drinking. And then later on that week, they found her dead, a drug overdose at the Alibaba Motel. You know. And it just was so sad. You know, I just couldn't believe this, you know. And that's what happens. If you stay in here long enough, guys, you'll see people go out and people die. People die anyway. In fact, no one's getting out alive. But but this disease of alcoholism, it's really tricky. It's really tricky, right? And so, of course, I had to do some, like, you know, major inventory, major writing. I thought, oh my God, you know. And luckily for me, I have always been blessed with good sponsorship. And, you know, there was another time in my sobriety where I was dating a girl, and you know, she got pregnant. She ended up terminating that pregnancy. You know, and guys, you can stay sober through no matter what happens. You can always stay sober. And that was also a very painful time in my life. There's been all kinds of things that have happened where I haven't had to drink. And that's what I'm saying. I've always been blessed with strong sponsorship. So if you're new in here tonight, I hope you find a sponsor you can get honest with. I really do. You know, I really do. You know, wonderful things have happened in my life. I only have a couple minutes, and I'll share with you a quote, and I'll tell you a quick story. This is my favorite quote. It was written by a guy named Bill. It goes like this. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a personal success story. Instead, it is the story of colossal human failure transformed into the happiest kind of usefulness through the divine alchemy of the loving grace of God. It's beautiful. And then, you know, there's a story. It's my favorite story. I always share this from the podium. It's the story of an accountant. A slow clap, thanks. She does. She's just slow clapping. It's nice to have fans. No. So there's a story of the accountant, right? And so basically, guys, there's this accountant. It's tax season. And he's crunching numbers. And he has a 5-year-old son. The son comes running up to him and he says, Dad, let's go outside and throw the ball. And the dad says, No, son, I'm busy. This is the worst time of the year. I can't play right now. The son is relentless. He says, come on. The dad looks on his desk and he sees a picture of a National Geographic. He looks at the National Geographic. On the back of the National Geographic, there's a picture of a map. He tears out the map and he hands it to the son. And he tears it up into 1,000 pieces and hands him some tape. He says, son, put this map back together, and when you're done, we'll go play baseball. Son runs out of the room, comes back 5 minutes later. He's got the map completely put back together. And the dad says, that's astonishing. I'm 40 years old. Not even I could do that. Son, how did you do that? He said, Dad, on the back of the map, there was a picture of a man. He said, I put the man back together, and the whole world fell into place. Thanks, guys.